This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy. And with us is a 21st Century Guy who needs no introduction.
I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters.
That, of course, is presidential hopeful Barack Obama. And while he might be a first in the history of presidential campaigning, he has plenty of company in the population at large. In the 2000 census, almost 7 million Americans checked two or more boxes when asked about their race.
Each week on Backstory, we take a current topic and tap its historical roots. This week, our topic is racial purity and the categories of black and white. Why have Americans worked so hard to maintain these categories, and how have our attitudes about race changed over time?
Now, what's remarkable about Barack Obama isn't simply his mixed race history, but that he's talking about it openly. Because for most of our history, we Americans have spent a lot more time protecting racial boundaries than challenging them.
Take, for instance, the case of Sally Hemings. She was the young slave who, as a teenager in 1787, went to work for Thomas Jefferson in Paris. There, they started an affair that lasted for many years and eventually produced four children. All of those children were later freed by Jefferson. Over the years, substantial evidence has emerged about all of this, and yet a lot of people still insist there was no affair, that Jefferson and Hemings were nothing more than master and slave. Why does the controversy persist? I recently sat down to discuss that question with one of the foremost experts on Jefferson and Hemings, Annette Gordon Reed. She explained that the Sally Hemings story starts long before Jefferson was even on the scene.
Sally Hemings was an enslaved woman who was born in 1773. She was the daughter of Elizabeth Hemings and John Wales, who was Jefferson's wife's father. So she was Jefferson's wife's half-sister. And she and her family came under Jefferson's ownership when John Wales died, and Martha, Thomas's wife, inherited his land and property, which included human property, namely the Hemingses and about 135 other enslaved people. And the Hemings family was pretty much installed as the house servants at Monticello. And apparently Martha, instead of hating her father's children by his mistress, apparently she was close to them. And they are part of her day-to-day life.
So one of the implications of this, Annette, is that Jefferson has to be fully aware of the broad ramifications of a liaison that he might begin with Sally Hemings.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that this was a thoughtless. This
right.
can't have been a thoughtless thing on his part. I mean, she could have had 14 kids. And he knew they would be at Monticello there with her family and with his family, with his daughters, you know, at the end of the day, living with him.
Yeah, yeah.
But he certainly knew that he was continuing the same thing that his father-in-law had done by having six children with Elizabeth Hemings, that he would be continuing that into another generation of people, sort of more deeply enmeshing these families yeah. together.
Annette, a lot of the fascination with the relationship between Hemings and Jefferson reflects our own kind of prurient sensibility. This is sort of gossip page stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the most pointed charges against Jefferson by people who are deeply disillusioned with Jefferson are that he raped Sally Hemings. How do you respond to when people say to you, Annette, let's get to the heart of the problem. This is a question of rape.
Well, I don't like categorical statements, bright line rules.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule is that if you're a slave, you can never consent to have sex with a master.
Right.
But really, you can never consent to have sex with a white person because every white person during that time period had incredible amounts of power over all black women. So this no possible consent rule, to my mind, is a shorthand that may describe the situation in general. But you have to look at individual people's lives. And if they are in Paris, it bothers me to think that he could rape her. Somebody could say he could rape her, and they know for a fact that she would just say, okay, I'm still going to go home with you. And that her brothers who would have known this too.
Yeah.
Even after they're emancipated, they give gifts to Jefferson. They visit him. They treat him like an in-law. They don't treat him like somebody who's raping their sister.
In effect, the strong statements about rape are a way of erasing Sally Hemings and other African Americans.
Exactly. When you look at the life of Betty Hemings, Elizabeth Hemings, Mary Hemings, Sally Hemings' older sister, these are women who form liaisons with people that ended up benefiting their children in many, many ways. And it struck me as I was writing this that this is not unlike the kinds of strategies and the kinds of things that women, free women, women throughout history have been forced to do because of women's subordinate status in the world. And that is to say, seek some level of stability and assurance of protection for their children by their relationships to men. And some people call it marriage, but they call other things.
Right,
and
exactly.
You have to be careful about that.
Right. The story of enslaved Africans and African Americans struggling against slavery is usually focused on resistance and the push for freedom.
Or resistance of a particular definition.
Yeah, yeah.
Resistance in the way men resist killing people. Conflict, that is the sort of ultimate form of resistance. But, I mean, Sally Hemings freed four people you know, and herself. I mean, some of these people with these insurrections, nobody was freed. And what do you do with, I mean, for Sally Hemings, I've asked people, well, you know, who do you think she would have ended up with? This is a girl who was a quarter black. Her father was white. Her grandfathers were white. Why do we assume, with our racial understandings, that a black man would be who she dreamed of? Do you know what I mean? That would be her sense of why, because we have defined her as black. This is all through the prism of our kind of understanding about the way the world works.
So, Annette, you've thought a lot about race and what it means to us today and what it meant to your subjects. How has your thinking evolved on these subjects?
Well, one thing that I've come to see is that race remains a very, very important thing to whites. I mean, I would say that white Americans, and I think black Americans as well, some group of them as well, are still not comfortable with the idea of interracial mixture. Mm-hmm. The idea that Jefferson could buy and sell people, separate mothers from their children, and that would not appall people.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that says that now his image is tarnished is that he got into bed with a black woman, I think is very instructive to me. And it's instructive to black Americans watching people have this kind of reaction. But I'm just, you know, shocked by people who think that the Hemings story in any way diminishes him as a person that we have to deal with in American history.
Yeah.
And it's back to what I said before about race, how important it remains for people to have this notion of a white, pure, founding father.
Yeah.
And how his engagement with her changes that. You know, this is so not, to my mind, important about him in terms of him as a world figure.
So it's not that you would say, let's ignore or set aside race, but there's a way of working through the race problem with Jefferson.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think what has happened is people have come to realize that you really can't talk about him seriously without engaging in this issue. And I think that may turn some people off. They would want to just go back to, can't we go back to the old days when it was when they were just sort of like the furniture? But now we really can't do that. And that's what makes him so important for the 21st century.
Annette, thank you for joining us on Backstory. It's been great to talk with you.
Same here.
Annette Gordon-Reed is a professor of history at Rutgers University, Newark, and professor of law at New York Law School. Her forthcoming book is called The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. It hits the bookstores this fall.
Peter, you know, Annette urged us to think about race the way people back then thought about race. But I want to know from you, how did Jefferson think about race?
That's a great question, Brian. The first thing to say is that Jefferson didn't think about race in the way we do. Nobody did. Jefferson even believed that through three crossings, that is black and white crossings over three generations, that you could become white. That is, that Sally Hemings's children would be themselves technically white under Virginia law. But you could say that though Jefferson doesn't have a fully developed idea of race and racial difference and the inferiority of Africans and African Americans. He does see the United States as a white man's country. And understanding that Jefferson himself was crossing that racial boundary is, I think, really important and interesting. That is, Jefferson was aware that you had to do something about slavery precisely because the temptations of interracial sex were irresistible for white planters who owned female slaves.
And it was not at all uncommon for there to be these kinds of liaisons all across the class range, all the way from the poorest whites and enslaved black people through people of middling property, all the way up to the elite. All of them found one another across the racial divide.
Let me ask you, when did that end? Did that endure throughout the 19th century, even after slavery?
No,
it's was slavery really the key?
Slavery is really the key because as soon as black people were able to police the boundaries of their homes under emancipation, they did that. So you have the paradox. The white South becomes obsessed with racial mixing while it's in sharp decline.
So, Ed, I understand with emancipation, African Americans being able to police their own boundaries better. I get that. But why the white obsession with this race mixing?
That's a great question. Part of it is, temptation doesn't go away just because the power to fulfill that temptation does. Mm-hmm. That's a large part of it. And so you found that white men were under the strong suspicion that white women felt the same attraction to African-American men that they felt toward African-American women. And now that African-American men were free, that threat seemed a lot more real than it did
So they had to self-police in order to protect their women.
Yeah.
An odd way.
We don't want to exaggerate. You know, there was still been a rite of passage for some young white men.
Right.
To patronize black prostitutes, and it would still deeply advantageous for some black women to establish liaisons with white men. But as something that was just generally looked beyond, it faded away with remarkable speed. So I think we tend to think of this ideas of racial purity as quite static, but in fact, they've been remarkably dynamic in the American South, where we think they probably changed the least.
This is Backstory, the show that looks at the present through the lens of the past. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Bellow. Today on Backstory, we're talking about the idea of racial purity and the reality of racial mixing. But all this talk about black and white is making me think about diversity. I think we need to bring a little diversity right in, right here. Peter, you got somebody on the line for us?
We got a call from Jonathan from right here in Charlottesville. Jonathan, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, good to be on.
Well, we're talking about race today, and do you have something on your mind?
Yes. In the mixed race community, a lot of people tend to identify using blood quantum.
Right.
So saying that, you know, I have one parent who's Asian, one parent who's Latino, therefore I'm half Asian, half Latino. And that's always struck me as a sort of weird way of looking at race, since it kind of presumes that if you have, you know, one grandparent of race A and three grandparents of race B, that you're somehow three times more B than A. And I guess I was just wondering if you guys could sort of talk about maybe historically how that kind of view of race in the mixed race community came to be and whether there are any kind of alternative ways people have looked at it.
Yeah, it has been the definition for centuries, and I think that's a great way of putting the blood quantum. But it is based on sort of a unitary belief that blood and the body are in one race, all of one unified form. And that the idea then that if you have people of different so-called races mixing, it must literally be different forms of blood as well as soul or spirit. That is also mingled as well.
Ed, I think there's another dimension to this, and that's what I call legal dimension.
Right.
And it goes back to inheritance, that is establishing who gets to inherit.
Yeah.
All the way from succession to kingship, who's going to be the next king, and to succession to property. So there's a legal interest in defining who has a right, and that becomes biological in our modern understanding.
And I would also say, Peter, that although I'm out of my century, it does seem that because there is much more reference to race and eventually biologically based race in the law itself, that has really encouraged people to define themselves racially in terms of these fractions, as opposed to ethnicity, for instance. The irony is that now in an era of affirmative action, we are back to being encouraged legally, in some instances, to define ourselves racially when we apply for college, for instance. Jonathan, would you like a portion of this conversation?
Well, I mean, what you say I think is kind of interesting about there are other ways of defining people's selves, like such as through ethnicity rather than simply fractionalization. And if you had any input on kind of why people are doing, I mean, you sort of mentioned, you know, college admissions, affirmative action as one.
Jonathan, I'm going to simply say that a lot of people define themselves in opposition to kind of prevailing attitudes in society. So when slaves arrived from very different countries in Africa, for instance, they didn't necessarily think of themselves as Africans or necessarily even black, but they were injected into an environment where it was to their advantage, certainly politically, to begin to identify around their common racial traits.
Yeah, right. It's interesting. We think about when enslaved people first came to British North America. By this time, there had been, you know, over a century of mixing all around the Atlantic world. And by the time the first enslaved people showed up here in 1619, questions of going native or mixing with Indian blood with the English was already very well established. And the idea of purity was something that people would not have considered a very achievable goal. But anyway, so the point is that this has a long history, and I think what we're looking for is a new language. We've basically had the same language for 400 years now, a proportionality of blood. So I think Jonathan's great question is to sort of shake us loose from what seems like a natural way of thinking, which is obviously, when you think about it for a second, completely false and misleading.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan.
Okay, bye.
So, Ed, Peter, we've been talking a lot about racial mixing and about how it's as old, maybe older, really, than America itself. But I'm still wondering about something. Where did this whole idea of race come from in the first place?
Well, Brian, the first thing I'd say is that the word race itself didn't refer to what we call racial groups in the 17th and 18th century. It really just meant any particular group of people. Ethnicity was often confused with race. Even the idea of a nation or a race, the Irish race, the English race, didn't have the kind of biological implication that it came to have in the 19th century. Wouldn't you say that's right, Ed?
Yeah, I think over the course of American history, what we see is that the practice of race changes before the language of it does.
Yeah,
right?
Good point.
You know, the old canard about, you know, slavery being an unintended consequence, or, you know, slavery happened when they were looking the other direction. And people looked around and said, whoa, look, we have slavery here. How do we explain it? Well, it must be because people of African ancestry must be destined to be enslaved in some ways.
And you could say that slavery then lent itself to the historic associations of Black and Western culture as a very negative term.
So it literally was the connection to slavery. Because Blacks were connected to slavery, they could be identified as Black.
As a matter of fact, that they had to be.
That they had to be, right.
My sense is that what we talk of as race now is a post-Civil War artifact. Because, mm-hmm. you know, they talked about Yankees and Confederates being of different races.
Absolutely.
But after emancipation, where they felt there needed to be a much stronger legal boundary between Black and white, white lawmakers felt compelled to prescribe who was white and who was Black. And they decided that even if there were one drop of Black blood as the metaphor went, in a person's veins, that person was therefore black, even though hair and skin pigmentation, anything else, might not indicate that.
So what you guys are saying, though, is the law is really crucial here, because when the law defines blacks as property under slavery, then people don't sweat the details on race.
Right.
But once that law is exploded, then the South comes up with extraordinary legal means of defining race in new
ways.
That
is, biology has to be codified.
Right.
It has to be legislated, because things aren't what they appear, because
right.
you've got a lot of anomalies, and therefore you've got to get the power of the state behind a ironclad definition of race.
Yeah, it's almost Orwellian. You know, race is not what you can see. It's what is inside in some almost viral sense, you know? And so it becomes very scary if you think about reading novels of William Faulkner about this hidden stains of blackness and so forth. And, you know, it's a big theme around the turn of the century in black and white authors of suicide and of discovered racial identity and things. So it becomes kind of an obsession.
So, Ed, speaking of this obsession with race and race mixing, do you think this country finally put that to bed with the Supreme Court decision in 1967 that ruled anti-miscegenation laws to be unconstitutional, the Loving decision?
It's remarkable that doesn't happen until the late 1960s, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, you know, law always matters, and it's remarkable the extent to which law has interacted with racial definition, and it's usually trying to catch up, you know. There's a great line in All the King's Men where he talks about the law is like a quilt that's too small to cover the bed. And so one side's always pulling it to try to cover themselves and exposing somebody else. And
wait, that's my quilt, actually. So, Peter, I hear we got another phone call.
We got Madeline from New York, New York. Madeline, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. How are you guys doing?
Great. So, race. What's on your mind?
Well, actually, I am calling because my friend Ken Tanabe and I, we run a nonprofit here in New York City called the Loving Day Project. And we throw a Loving Day celebration every year. The thing that we find very consistent is that the Loving decision is very rarely known in our generation. Everyone knows about Rosa Parks and Brown versus Board of Education, but what do you think, as historians, needs to happen for a big case to become well-known history?
Let's just start by asking you how and why you became aware of this decision and why it means so much to you.
Well, you know, I moved to the United States when I was 8 years old from Japan. Mm-hmm. My father's Japanese. He's actually mixed himself. And my mother is American. She was raised here.
Right.
I didn't even know about the Loving decision until I moved to New York and I met Ken Tanabe.
To answer your question about, you know, from our perspective as historians, what happens to get publicity for cases? Certainly, you've done a lot, and that's an important piece of the story. But generally, what happens is anniversaries, deaths. As you know, Mrs. Loving died very recently. So I saw a story about this in the New York Times, which was built around her death. But in fact, the story talked about the community that both the Lovings came from in Caroline County, which ironically turned out to be a community that was inhabited by a lot of mixed-race people, an irony of ironies. So death is one thing that brings people's attention back to historical decisions. But much more importantly, and this is where I started noticing Loving popping up again in the news, and that's analogies. And now the analogy, Loving, a black woman and a white man not being allowed legally to marry each other, the current analogy is, can gay people marry each other? And that analogy is on Fox News, and it's in the New York Times.
Right.
It's all over, with a lot of references back to Loving.
Brian, it's a great point, but you also said something I thought was very, very interesting, and that is that in Caroline County, there were mixed-race people. In other words, Loving isn't the beginning of race mixture. So in some ways, with the recognition of Loving and the legalization of interracial marriage, we're just recognizing a social fact. It says, oh my God, look, this is the way it's always been.
That's exactly right. And the original question here about how do you get more attention for Loving, the point is it was a big deal because the whole drift of state power was to police these things ever tighter, and then suddenly it pivots into greater equality. So I think you have, in terms of marketing, however, a great name, Loving Day.
Yeah. I was going to add, that's another
Virginia
ingredient.
Virginia is for the Lovings, yeah.
I know, we couldn't have asked for a better name.
Thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you so very much for answering my question.
Before we take another call, I just want to mention that we've already gotten a bunch of really great comments about our topic on our website. Have a look at backstoryradio.org to see what people are saying.
Okay, we got another call, guys. It's from Arlington, Massachusetts. It's Owinja calling. Owinja, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
We're talking about race today. I bet you got something to tell us.
Well, when I came in from Kenya, I went straight to Montpelier, Vermont.
Whoa.
And stayed there for 2 years and then moved to Philadelphia. Now, the interesting thing was, I actually felt at home and felt connected in Montpelier than I did when I moved to Philadelphia, even though in Philadelphia I had more people that looked like me. And so my question is, why is that? What is that phenomena?
Oh, I think that's a great question. And Montpelier is one of my favorite places. It's the smallest state capital in the country. It's like a big village, isn't it? I mean, you really felt that you knew people in Montpelier, didn't you?
I did feel at home and met friends, and I was myself. In Philadelphia, I was a person with the same skin color, but I just didn't walk the walk, didn't talk the talk, and just I disappointed them.
So that's really interesting what you're saying about not being comfortable in Philadelphia, even though you could see yourself as you walk down the street, that is, people like you.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? What's your theory about this?
Well, let's fast forward about 10 years, 15 later, and I have a daughter who is mixed race.
Uh-huh.
And in her class, there's one mixed race child and another black child.
Owinja, where are we? Are we in Philadelphia or Arlington now?
We are in Arlington, Massachusetts.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
For the longest time, there was a lot of friction between my daughter, who is 10, and her classmate. And at the end of the year, my daughter told me that I just don't understand why I call her Mary, doesn't understand why I don't know what MTV is, or I don't know who Beyonce is, or I don't know what BET is.
Right. So you're saying because her skin color is darker, there's a certain set of cultural expectations.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, look, my kids are mixed race, African-American and white, and, you know, they get it from both sides. And I can't tell you exactly why that is, except the one thing that I will say is it's the result of a very, very long history and legacy of race that makes any kind of racial difference fair game for adolescent, particularly meanness, nastiness, whatever.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, the way that it's encoded in popular culture. The examples you used, you know, BET, MTV, and hip-hop music, and all these different kinds of things. At the same time that we think that sort of race may be diluted a little bit because people are marrying across racial lines, it's encoded and emphasized over and over again every day in our popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though 70% of the people who listen to hip-hop music are supposedly white, that's actually a pressure for hip-hop to be very black rather than for it to be diluted.
But you've also put your finger on one of the themes of this show today, which is, you know, we want to be colorblind, we want to be accepting, we want to be forgiving, but there is still racism out there. And because there's racism out there, you got to choose a side.
Yeah.
And people who are mixed, they literally get caught in the middle on that, or often they choose sides. You know,
But Brian, can't you choose more than one side?
Absolutely.
You're framing this in binary terms. You're one thing or another. And often the questions, as Owinja's daughter faced questions, are you with us or against us? Are you one of us? Are you not? But there's a positive assertion of diversity that I think is increasingly being heard. I'm both, and I'm proud to be both. You know, am I being too optimistic?
Yeah, I think you are.
Oh, come on.
Come on, Ed, tell us.
Well, it's only in the sense that, you know, being a little black doesn't really make sense in the United States.
Yeah.
If, you know, this goes way back, you know, the one drop rule. If you have any, as they say, black blood in you at all, then you are black.
Yeah, but I want to get back to our caller and ask what you think your daughter's mixed race has to do with your own immigration from another country. I mean, that would seem to complicate things even further.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that we joke about, my husband, is he grew up Midwestern, white, middle class, and I grew up in Kenya. We don't know anything about raising a child who's black in this country.
You raise, I think, a terribly important point. We tend to talk about identity as though it is ours to choose. And in fact, in so many instances, and certainly historically, it's the case that the identity that people have is the one that in essence is imposed upon them by others who, whatever I might think in my own mind, everyone else out there is looking at me as X or Y or Z. So when we talk about identity, it's really not always up for grabs.
Thanks for that great call. It's been fun talking to you, Awinja.
Thank you very much, Awinja.
Thanks.
Okay.
It's time for another break. When we get back, we'll ask whether there's any difference between race consciousness and racism.
And we'll take more of your calls. If you want to be a caller on an upcoming show, visit our website and find out how. We're at backstoryradio.org.